If you have your Bibles, if you could open up to John chapter 12. John chapter 12, we're going to be in verses 20 through 28 this morning. April 4th, 2003, at Reunion Arena in Dallas, Texas, I experienced a life-changing event. Life-changing. I saw the rock band U2 in concert during their Elevation tour. There was so much hype, there was so much energy, there was so much buildup prior to the concert. I got my tickets like 6 months in advance, and for 6 months in my car, the only thing it was playing was U2 classic stuff. At my home, in my computer when I was at work, just nothing but U2. There was so much buildup in anticipation. So my buddy Evan, who I went to the concert with, he picks me up. And we start to drive downtown, and you can feel like the electricity in the car. And of course, we've got U2 plugged in. We walk into Reunion Arena and see thousands of other gleaming, gleeful U2 fans, which we're about to worship and have fellowship with. I found that concert t-shirt that I had just been dreaming about. You know, you walk in, and it's just the racks of concert t-shirts up there. And you're like, I'll pick that one. You know, and it's like $180 and they give it to you, but it's totally worth it. So we find our seats, you know, all of the house lights are on, none of the stage lights are on, and literally I feel my heart beating because I've loved U2 since I was a kid, like junior high, I was into U2. And the time for the concert to start rolls around, all the house lights are on, none of the stage lights on, and U2 just casually walks out on the stage, picks up their instruments and starts playing the intro to this song, Elevation. And then at that moment, when the song shifts into nothing but hardcore, pure, high-energy rock and roll, all of the house lights went off and all of the stage lights came on in all of its glory. And it was beautiful. And we saw and we beheld U2 in all of their glory. It was unbelievable. It was awesome. Stage lights come on and... it was great. Today is Palm Sunday. It's the first day of the Passion Week, and this week all the lights on the stage come up, and there is Jesus, the crucified, risen Lord, standing center stage, all of the house lights down, all of the stage lights come up. It's Palm Sunday. It's the beginning of this thing in the Christian world, in our Christian faith, in the church that we call the Passion Week. 51 weeks out of the year, we're praising, we're singing our great God, and then all of a sudden, the lights on the stage come up, and we see Jesus for all that He is and all of His mission, and all of His glory, and all of His splendor. In Luke 9:51, Luke says, when the time of His ascension was approaching, He set His face towards Jerusalem. The New American Standard says He was determined to go to Jerusalem. That's code for He was going towards the cross. You see this momentum pick up in the Passion Week, and everything else, in a sense, fades away, and Jesus' face is set towards the cross and towards the resurrection. So this morning, on this Palm Sunday, my heart for you is that you'd see Jesus with all of the stage lights cranked up to max, and somehow you would behold Him in all that He is. So we're going to be in John chapter 12 this morning, in verses 20 through 28. And we're just going to walk through this passage. And so if you would read with me, I would love it. John chapter 12, verses 20 through 28. Now there were some Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These then came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip came and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip came and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, saying, The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it. And he who hates his life in this world will keep it to life eternal. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I came to this hour. So, Father, glorify your name. When the lights come up on Jesus, what do you see and what do you experience? That's the question I want you to wrestle with this morning. I want you to, in a sense, contemplate it and meditate upon it all week as we come into Good Friday and we come into Resurrection Sunday, Easter Sunday. When the lights come up and Jesus is center stage, what do you see and what do you experience? I want to set the stage for you that what's going on in this passage. This is the turning point. This verse right here in the middle, verse 23, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. This is the turning point in the entire Gospel of John. Prior to the lights coming on, at this point, there's been all of this hype. There's been all of this buildup. There's been all of this anticipation. And it's like the wheels are moving and they start to pick up speed. And finally, we get to this verse. All up to this point, four times in the Gospel of John, Jesus has said, this is not yet my hour, or my time has not yet come. If you remember in John chapter 2, Jesus and his disciples and his mom, they're invited to a wedding at Cana. And here, listen for that phrase that my hour has not yet come. John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come. We flip over five chapters to John chapter 7. His brothers are in some sense kind of challenging him to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles, which is in Jerusalem. But already seven chapters into John, there's a plot to kill Jesus because he's this renegade rabbi and the religious powers don't really like his message that he's saying. And so in a sense, they're kind of goading him in verse 3 in chapter 7. Therefore, his brothers said to him, leave here and go into Judea so that your disciples also may see your works which you're doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers were believing in him. So Jesus said to them, my time is not yet here. Once again, later on in John chapter 7, the religious leaders are seeking to find him and kill him. And it says no one laid their hands on him because his hour had not yet come. It says that again in John chapter 8, verse 20, same scenario. They're seeking to lay their hands on him, but nobody did because his hour had not yet come. So there's this anticipation. There's this hype that's building up. And all of a sudden, back in John chapter 12, at this moment, Jesus says, this is the hour in which the Son of Man must be glorified. This is the time. All the stage lights come up to be glorified. Now, what's interesting is Jesus says, this is the time, this is the hour, this event, the cross, the resurrection, the Passion Week, in which the Son of Man must be glorified. That whole idea, to be glorified, it's the Greek verb which means to give praise or to exalt, to honor. But it comes from a root, doxē, in the Greek, which actually means, the noun form means splendor. It means brilliance. It means light. And so there's this image of it. When you glorify something, you shine the spotlight on it to see all of its brilliance, all of its beauty. This week I was thinking about an image. I'm kind of a movie guy. I love film. I especially love indie films. I love films that are creative and artistic. I love when filmmakers and directors and cinematographers, they use lighting. They use the whole aesthetic, and light does so much to a movie. And so all week I've been pictured this. At this moment when Jesus says these words, I picture the film. I just picture everything stopping. I picture everything going into slow motion. I picture all the house lights coming down. And I picture, if you've ever been in a theater and there's that poignant moment where they spotlight the main character and you hear the crank of the lever of the spotlight and it echoes throughout and the spotlight shines on Jesus. This is his time, this event, this cross, this resurrection. Now is the time for the Son of Man to be glorified. You know, when you walk into somebody's house and they have something that's of value, some artistic piece. Sometimes it's a piece of china. Sometimes it's an antique. Sometimes it's on a mantle. Sometimes it's in a display case. Sometimes it's a glorious, beautiful guitar that's on this beautiful stand in the corner. And, and the light from the windows is shining upon it. When people have something they want to display, something that's of value, something that's unique and beautiful, what do? They put a light on it. The mantle. How oftentimes you walk in and you see this beautiful picture and it's got the mantle light? Or you walk into a hallway and you see family pictures. Whatever we value, whatever we honor, we display and we put light upon it so it draws our attention. In a sense, this is what God does. Cranks up the lights. Jesus, spotlight. Now is the time. The stage is set. So, if the spotlight, the lights come up on Jesus at this time, what do we see and what do we experience of Jesus? Let's walk into the text a little bit. The first thing I think we see is this. When the lights come up on Jesus, we see and we experience Jesus' heart and his love for the world. Now, the context of this is there's the triumphal entry in John chapter 12. It starts back in verse 12, the triumphal entry. And if you remember, sometimes you've been to a church and all the little kids come in and they're waving palm branches and we're singing, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That's what was happening. In Jerusalem, there was a feast going on. People were pilgrimaging. Is that a word? Is it? Okay, that was a hard word to say. So they're all trekking upwards towards Jerusalem. There's thousands of people there. There's thousands of people who have heard across the countryside that Jesus, hey, this guy raised Lazarus from the dead. He's been doing all of these miracles. It's amazing to see what he's doing. And all of these people, Jesus comes in to fulfill this ancient prophecy. And he comes in and he's side-sitting on a donkey that's coming into the streets. And people are waving palm branches, laying them down and saying, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. This is the King. This is our Savior. All of this kind of stuff. And the Pharisees, remember the Pharisees? Kind of the bad guys in the story. They have this plot to kill Jesus. And I love it in verse 19. So the Pharisees said to one another, you see that you're not doing any good. Look, the world has gone after him. In this moment of what I like to call frustrated hyperbole, they have no idea what they're saying. I mean, they're just hacked off that their gig somehow is not getting as much press as Jesus. And they're saying, look, man, what we're trying to do, it's not doing any good because the whole world is going after this guy. They had no idea how right they are. And what's amazing, the next part of the story, the very next verse, now there were some Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. Now, these Greeks, we don't know if they're what we call God-fearers. Maybe they are Greeks that have left the pantheon of their Roman cultural gods. Maybe they have converted, and we would call them proselytes, and they've converted to worship Yahweh, the God of the Jews. We don't know exactly who they are, but they're going up to celebrate and to worship at this feast, the Passover. But we do know this one thing. Whenever you see the word Greek, it means outsider. It means Gentile. It means pagan. It means heathen. When you see that. In fact, there were so much outsiders in the Jewish religion that during King Herod's reign, which this is all happening during, they reconfigured the temple and they had the Holy of Holies, which was in the very center. And there were all of these rings or these courts that were going in concentric rings around the Holy of Holies. The closer you got to get in to the center, the cooler you were. The better your status was, you know, the closer you got to get to God, the more the insider you were. You know where the Greeks got to go? The very, very outer ring. I mean, there was a wall called a balustrade, and it was maybe even 8 or 9 feet high. And unless you were, you know, Shaq, and you could, you know, look over the top, you couldn't even see what was going on. They said, you guys are outsiders. And I don't care how much you want to convert, fear God, you're outsiders. And so all of a sudden, these guys are coming up. They're going to worship at this feast and they say, you know what? We want to see Jesus. Not just see him, because they could see him at any time. They said, we want to meet this guy. We want to dialogue with this guy. We've heard things about him. So they go up to Philip. Now, I don't know. Philip is one of Jesus' disciples. We don't know why. Maybe Philip has a Greek name. His name literally means lover of horses. He is from the northern part of Israel in Bethsaida along the Sea of Galilee, which is pretty near Phoenicia over on the coast. And the Decapolis and some areas where there was maybe a greater concentration of non-Jews, of Gentiles, and say, well, maybe this guy's our ticket in. So they come up to Philip and said, hey, man, we want to go see Jesus. And Philip's kind of, he goes, man, I don't know if we're seeing Greeks right now. So he goes and he asks Andrew. He says, hey, Andrew, I mean, is Jesus seeing Greeks right now? I mean, is that cool? Like, I don't know. So they go and they ask Jesus. And so they come up and Jesus says, now is the time, the hour in which the Son of Man must be glorified. Now, we don't know if these Greeks got to have an exclusive audience with Jesus. We don't know if he's talking and he's saying, hey, disciples, Philip, Andrew, all of you other disciples, those who are following me, something has changed. The spotlight just came up. And what the Pharisees just said, the whole world is now going to come after me. Now is the time. We don't know who the audience is, but I know this, that Jesus has a heart for the world. Remember back in John 3:16? Maybe for some of you, the first Bible verse you ever memorized, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. When the lights come up on Jesus, we see and experience his heart and his love for the world. You know, it's cool is I get to see that all the time. It's really cool spending time in this passage, in this point, in seeing how true what the Pharisees said, the whole world is going after him. I look around and I see your faces, and each one of you that I know part of your story, I know that God, through Jesus, has transformed your life in some way. I know that when the lights come up and you see Jesus' heart for the world, his life changing, his transformation has had an arrow straight to your heart. Marriages have been healed. Families have been restored. Lives have been fixed. When the lights come up and you see Jesus, he has a heart for the world. You can drive 7 miles north of here, get on 43, drive downtown, go to this little rundown hotel called Swindells, and you can see the light of Jesus and all of his glory and his heart for the world penetrating into this little dark hotel where Debbie Wakeling and a couple of other people who really love Jesus are sharing the love of Jesus. They've been doing a Bible study there for about a year, 112 residents at this point. Somewhere 15, 20 people have come to Jesus, people who are drug addicts and alcoholics and one step above homeless. Jesus' light is shining in transforming lives. We had a team that just got back from El Salvador about a week ago. And in this little bitty village in northern El Salvador, north of this little town called Suchitoto, there's this little bitty village that's got a couple of foundations and maybe about 5 homes on it that are maybe the size of your bathroom. Okay, and the village is called Nuevo Renacer, which means new beginning. When the lights come up, we're seeing Jesus' love for these people, and lives are starting to get changed. 18 months ago, I was in West Africa, in Ghana. I got to hang out with some folks from the Dagomba tribe. Over 90% Muslim. Most of them have this weird pagan, animistic ancestor worship that they mix in with their Muslim faith. And it's amongst the Dagomba tribe, when the lights come up and they see Jesus in all of his glory, they leave their tribe and they join his tribe. It was amazing to see that. In China, right now the estimates are that 70 million Chinese have come to Christ out of a population of 1.3 billion. That's about 10,000 Chinese every day are going after Jesus. By the year 2050, statistics say that China will be the largest Christian nation in the world. The Pharisees had no idea how right they were when they said, look, the whole world has gone after him. It's huge. It's immense. I can't imagine the words. I mean, it's cataclysmic. Is that good? It's epic. It's cosmic. It's this big picture that God in his heart from creation through the fall is doing this thing of recreation and redemption, and it's centered and the spotlight comes up and it's Jesus, the cross, the resurrection. And it's huge and it's bold and I love it and it just gets my heart beating. But here's something else, that when the lights come up, as big and as beautiful and as bold as that is, next we shift to something that's intimate and that's personal and that's painful. Look at what he says. When the lights come up on Jesus, we see and we experience that Jesus is willing to enter into and to embrace all of the pain and the difficulties of life. Did you hear that? When the lights come up on Jesus, we see that He's willing, not just pushed into it, He's willing to enter into and to embrace all of the pain and the difficulties of life. I think really this is one of my favorite parts of this passage. Look at verse 27. Jesus says, "Now my soul has become troubled." You know what amazes me about Jesus? When the lights come up on the stage and all the house lights go on, Jesus is actually standing there on the stage. I mean, that's a moment of profound courage. He knows what's coming, right? He's God. He's omniscient. That means all-knowing. He knows that one of His friends is going to kiss Him on the cheek in this garden in which He's just cried out that the Father would take this cup. And the Gospels tell us it was so tragic and painful for Him that He sweat drops of blood. He knew that that night of Thursday night after the Passover, that He was going to be arrested in this garden, and these religious leaders of this nation that He really came to save the Jews, the final act of betrayal, and they just give Him a crown of thorns with these Roman soldiers, and the next day He knows what's coming. He knows the horror of what it's going to feel like to have spikes driven through His arms and His legs, and He's nailed to a tree by a bunch of pagan soldiers. But most importantly, He knows what's going to happen, and somehow the agony that He's going to experience, that for the first time in eternity, He's separated from the Father. Jesus, the spotlight comes on, and He's there on the stage. But you know what amazes me even more than that He's there? He tells us how he's feeling. Do you guys notice that? He says, "Now my soul has become troubled." That word troubled, it means frightened. It means terrified. I mean, usually it's Jesus who's telling other people not to be terrified, right? You go through the Gospels and it's usually the numbskull disciples or people who lack faith. And He's saying, "Look, relax, chill, I got it. Don't be troubled. It's going to be okay." And at this moment He says, "I'm troubled. My soul is troubled. I know what's coming. I'm troubled." But you go a couple chapters over into John 14, 1, and in this intimate moment with the disciples in this upper room, He looks at them, and I imagine Him sitting there at this table, and I imagine Him just kind of scanning and locking eyeballs with them. And He says this. He says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, and also believe in Me." I think He says this. He goes, "Guys, I know what you're feeling. I've entered into that. I've embraced that. I know that the fear that you have, you've been following Me for 3 years. You're planning on this kingdom coming in and being glorious. And I'm telling you, I'm going to a cross. I know how you feel. But don't be troubled. God is there. He is in the moment with you in all of your pain and all of your suffering." He says, "In fact, I'm going to experience some more of it tonight and tomorrow. And I'm going to enter into it and to embrace it fully." That's the beauty of Jesus during the Passion Week when the lights come up. You know, but this is nothing new that Jesus is willing to enter into and embrace our pain. I want you to listen to a couple of passages. If you want to turn there, beautiful. If you want to close your eyes and listen to this, listen to these passages and listen, I guess, to the emotion of these biblical writers, and when they're saying that Jesus, the Son of Man, this Messiah, this King, God Himself, would enter into and embrace all of our pain and difficulties. Isaiah 53, verse 3, "He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their face, He was despised, and we did not esteem Him. Surely our griefs He Himself bore, and our sorrows He carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed Him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But He was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon Him, and by His stripes we are healed." Hebrews 2, verse 17, "Therefore, He had to be made like His brethren in all things, so that He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he's able to come to the aid, to the rescue of those who are tempted. Listen to Hebrews 4:14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in a time of need. When the lights come up on Jesus, the glory and the splendor and the beauty is that the God-man would be willing to enter into and to embrace all of the pain, all of the challenges, all of the difficulties in your life and say, look, I've been there. Do not be troubled. In fact, I'll take all of that stuff to the cross. I'll take it all if you'll trust me. So here's the picture I get of Jesus. I get the picture of the spotlight shining upon him. And I guess I just picture this hand outstretched. He's saying, look, will you just turn your eyes? Turn your eyes to me. The old hymn written in 1922, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look into his wonderful face, and all the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Listen to me. All you've got to do is turn your eyes upon Jesus. That's what this Passion Week is about. The spotlight is on. He has this huge heart for the world. It's big. It's epic. It's changing the world. And once again, the Pharisees had no idea. But look, the world has gone after him. But then at the same moment, he turns the corner. And in this quiet moment, in this hushed voice, he says, look, I'm willing to enter into whatever's going on in your life. This is the beauty of the Passion Week. 51 weeks out of the year, we worship and we sing about Jesus and we focus on Jesus. But somehow, God in his providence and his design, he designed this 1 week for us to hyper-focus, for the spotlights to come on. Now is the time in which the Son of Man must be glorified. Here's a question I want to ask you that I want you to wrestle with and I want you to take with you. When you see the spotlight come up on Jesus, what about him? What about his uniqueness? What about his beauty? What about his splendor, his radiance? Most grabs your heart. What is it? What most do you identify with? Some of you who have the heart for the whole world, it's this epic theological thing and it causes you to worship. Some of you are just in immense pain and you say, Jesus, God himself, God with us, Emmanuel, would reach his hand down into my pain through the cross, through the resurrection, and he would give me a nuevo renacer, a new beginning, a new life. What is it?